Welcome to the talk show worth talking about, Healing Stigma on Left of Straight Radio, with your co-hosts, Kevin Hogan, founder of the Healing Stigma Program, and Scott Fullerton, voice of Left of Straight Radio. From A-list entertainers to hometown heroes, join Kevin and Scott as they interview those on the cutting edge of challenging stigma with insight, humor, and always compassion. Give them your ears and they'll open your mind. For positive talk with positive results, you're listening to Healing Stigma on Left of Straight Radio. Now here are your hosts, Scott and Kevin.
Well, welcome everybody. It is Thursday, May 12th. Thanks so much for coming back to the show. I'm your host, Scott Fullerton, as always with my co-host, Kevin. Kevin, how you doing today?
Oh, it's the sun is out. I've got a couple of sleeping dogs at my feet here. It's just a lovely, lovely afternoon. How are you?
I am doing fantastic, my friend. Thank you so much for
Good. Asking.
Been a great week over here. You've had a lot of stories. I'm reading my Huffington Post as usual, and all of a sudden I see your byline again. Congratulations on another new story.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, well, sometimes those things just have to be written from a particular angle. If, you know, this one was, it was like a thorn in my brain, so I had to do it. And I thought the timing was right. And, yeah, we'll see what happens. But I would love it if people haven't read it yet. Just take a second and give it a read. It was a real, again, a pleasure to write.
Well, it's a great article. Again, it's in the HuffPost. Go ahead and give everyone a brief overview of what it is, at least.
Well, I'm probably being the word police here, I guess, but I just got so sick about that phrase, and this has nothing to do with telling people how to vote. So I mean, there's plenty of that that's going to happen and all that, plenty of those discussions, but I think we had such a lovely conversation last week, wasn't it, Dr. Johnny Bowden? We kind of went off a little bit on naturally current
right.
events, and Johnny came in, and he wanted to keep going. It wasn't like we forced him into current
yeah,
events.
Exactly.
So maybe
exactly.
some of the residue on that finally pushed it. But I was really, over the course of this, you know, election, whatever it is, circus so far, sick of seeing how Make America Great Again, that phrase again, has an implication
right.
that America is not great now, but then in a dangerous fashion, kind of, I feel, as a grammarist, let's say, maybe the English teacher in me comes up, but to make America great again, meaning it's not now, getting people very upset over something, rattling sabers over something in the nostalgic past when America was great, and then letting the mind of each individual go to there, it's kind of a dangerous thing to do, and it's certainly not a good game plan for leading a country, in my estimate. And so I wrote what I feel, I'll just give the title, We the People Make America Great. And it's something that I feel is an ongoing, you know, it's not, it wasn't like, bang, we're here in a peaceful way in this land, it was given to us, and then it's always been like this and always will be. No, it's been quite a struggle. So I kind of thought about it from what I feel makes America great, and I wrote about it, and I suggested it to whoever's running for office to maybe give this article a read if they want. It's a free class from old Kevin Hogan.
There you go. I love
yeah.
it. I hope everyone will go to the HuffPost and look at that right away. We're going to have a fantastic guest today. We had
yeah.
such a great response to Johnny last week, his fat loss summit. He still has packages together. If you have not looked at it yet, please go to our website, www.healingstigmaradio.com. Check out that website and look over Johnny's fat loss summit from last week, because we've had such great response
yep.
about that. And today's
hey,
guest
check us out on Twitter.
Check
us out on Twitter and follow us, because last time I checked, we were just about or have gone over the 1,000 mark. It's, you know, it's really growing. You know, every listener, every follow at a time. It's such a pleasure to see that happening. So thank you.
Exactly. At
yeah.
Heal Stigma Radio is our Twitter handle, and we always use the hashtag Heal Stigma Radio as well. So please go ahead and do that. But we have a fantastic guest today. He's going to be coming online in just a couple of moments. Fantastic story. Ryan Skinner, he's a fellow Bostonian like you. So
yeah.
You guys will have that in common. And
yeah.
I'm ready for it. Usually, I can understand you 99.9% of the time, but I'm a little bit afraid with two Bostonians in the room that I'm going to need to either get my Rosetta Stone or have Wahlburgers on speed dial and ask Mark or Marky Mark or something to help me
right,
out.
Well, I'll give you the crash course. Here's the crash course. Are you ready?
Okay.
Are you ready? All right.
I'm ready.
What are khakis? What are khakis?
Khakis are pants.
No, they're the thing you start your car with. Khakis.
Oh, God. Okay. All right. The two of you are going to tell
I'll help
me.
You. I'll translate. Right. I'll translate. I'll help you.
All right. I appreciate it.
All right.
Well, we're going to go ahead and go to a quick break here and be back with Ryan Skinner and have this amazing story just a little bit. He has a fantastic story of recovery. And we're playing music today. I got to tell you, Kevin, on my show on Tuesday, I had a new band called Mildly Medicated. These are a great group of kids, five kids, ages 18 to 20. And it's just amazing. So they're kind of a rockish band. So you're going to hear a little a rock sound here. But they have a lead singer with hemophilia, one guitarist with ADD, another guitarist with diabetes, a bassist with Tourette's, and a drummer on human growth hormone therapy. So it's like, so Mildly Medicated is the name. They have to travel along with a hazmat thing, but they're the greatest group of kids you've ever seen in your entire life.
That's
so I'm
awesome.
So excited to feature their music today. So we're
going
to start off with Mildly Medicated's song, Leave This One Behind, and we're going to be back in just a couple of moments with the amazing Ryan Skinner and his story. This is Scott and Kevin on Healing Stigma on Left to Straight Radio. We'll be right back. All right, and that was the band Mildly Medicated with their song Leave This One Behind. Huge hit right now in the UK and the US, so we're so excited for this great young up-and-coming band. Well, Kevin and I are really excited to have our special guest on tonight. He's a fellow Bostonian with Kevin and literally has been through hell and made it out the other side. He is currently co-owner of Summit Financial Partners in Woburn, Mass., who I probably pronounced wrong. They'll correct me, I'm sure, who has won back the respect and admiration of all his peers and clients after a downward spiral at the mercy of multiple addictions. Starting simply as stress-relieving cocktails, gradually turning to more and alcoholism, a hand surgery and a stomach surgery, brought prescription painkillers into the mix. He decided to turn his life around with the help of his sponsor and an old mentor and now business partner. He's doing so fantastic. I'm so excited to have him on the show. Please welcome Ryan Skinner. Ryan, how are you?
I'm doing well, fellas. How you doing?
We're doing great. Thanks. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you guys having me.
I'm so thrilled to have you on the show. And just for our listeners, Ryan and I haven't met yet. We're going to definitely get together and probably enjoy a beer. And I was giving Scott the chance to say, ask any questions he wants. But Ryan, I'm so thrilled because, you know, you coming on the program to learn of what you do in the fine state of Massachusetts. But I think it's going to have a knock-on effect naturally, nationally and internationally as well. But thanks for being on the show today, man. Nice to meet you.
Thanks, guys, so much. I think it's really important to see people out here fighting to remove stigmas for any issue. We all have I always say, You look at anybody, somebody's got something they're feeling pain with.
Well, Exactly. It's funny. I love your publicist, Thomas. He's a great guy. And I asked him to send me over any clients he has that might work for either my entertainment show or this show. He sends me over your profile, and I go ahead and look at your website. And the first thing it says is about the hashtag State Without Stigma for Massachusetts. I thought that was fantastic. Like, duh, we got to have this guy on our show, Kevin. And we're just so excited to have you here.
Guys, I'm so excited to be here. You know, I've gotten so involved. When I first got in recovery, it's like anything else. You're so busy, especially in this world today. You're so filled with shame that you almost don't go out and do the positive things to help others because you just want to fly into the radar and don't even admit that you had that. It's almost like you want to look the other way and say, oh, God, people have that issue. Oh, those poor people, you know, rather than say, hey, I am one of them.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's go ahead. We always like to start from the beginning when we have for the first time. Talk to us about growing up. I know you graduated a degree in finance from Merrimack University. You're quickly off position in a prestigious firm and went on to open your own financial business. So what kind of a kid were you? Were you the normal kind of sneaking beers as a kid, drugs or everything?
Talk about your early life
and what drove you into some of these later addictions.
Cool, man. I'm going to look at the clock here, guys, because I want to make sure I stay on track for you. Well, you know, sometimes you go so far down one path, you're like, oh, I missed out on this and this. Here it is.
No worries.
So, So here's the jump start. At a young age, I had terrible, terrible anxiety. I would see something on TV about moles and people having cancer, and I would call my mother up if she was at work and say, I think I have cancer. I see something about a heart attack, and I thought I'd have a heart attack. And I'll tell you this, it all seemed so real when it was going on, real. And my stepdaughter's going through that now, and everybody gives her a hard time and says, get over it. She goes, you're so understanding. I go, because I was you. And she finds it hard to believe because these days I don't carry too many fears with me. As I got older, so that was one big fear. As I got a little older, I just had different fears and insecurities. I was very, very insecure kid. I was what I call surface friendly. Like, everybody thought I was comfortable in my own skin, outgoing, friends, into sports. I was dying inside. I would smile, but I'd be so afraid that somebody's going to make fun of me. Even jokes that guys made towards each other, just kind of breaking them on each other, or friends made, I would take those to heart, and they would really hurt me, and I'd be thinking to myself, I'd hate the person for a few minutes. So that evolved.
And hey, Ryan, can I just interrupt here? Because Scott knows I do this. This is the way to words. You know, this is one of the points where people, as you said, you take it to heart. Well, it's not your fault that you take it to heart. That's the weight of words. And when we really think about what we say sometimes, it's a world sometimes that gets very quickly desensitized when we see what's going on, the way words and insults are thrown around, especially amongst friends and even with family. When family does it to each other, it can still hurt and cut like a knife. Sorry to interrupt, but go ahead, Ryan.
No, words do hurt. And I tell people all the time, I'd rather you stab me in a heartbeat than say what I really truly mean. But this, just so you know, what I'm referring to wasn't mean. It was friends joking with each other.
Right, and it wasn't things
that were like low hits or areas of insecurity. It was everything made me insecure. So you fast forward, I get to high school, and luckily in seventh grade, a teacher of mine had read a book by the great Peter Lynch. She was a private school teacher, and she knew she wouldn't have Social Security. She was saving for her own retirement. So, and one of the quotes was, if you can understand enough to draw with a crayon, you can own it. I mean, if you can learn mm-hmm. enough about investment that much, you can actually own it. That's how you have a right to justify buying it. So she thought, geez, I'll teach a few of these kids. Maybe they'll understand it. I was gifted in math, but at that point in time, I also had serious learning disabilities. I remember being in fifth grade in public school, and a student, when it was my turn to read, the way it would go across the class, Thursdays was my turn, that I'd have to read a paragraph. And he'd go, I'm retarded. And I'll never forget. So eventually I ended up punching this kid and knocking him out. And I was just, I was in a lot of pain. And so from there it progressed. So that was, when she taught me, I ended up saying, okay, I've learned this. And basically from there I knew how to take it somewhere. I said, okay, I understand this. This I can work with. I became, got into the financial side of things. I then said, okay, now I'm talented. I got involved in Peter Lynch. I was in a book of his, in a magazine, Women's World magazine, called The Whiz Kids of Wall Street, a few of us.
Wow.
And then when I got to high school, I ended up going across the street to a high school called Allen's Catholic. And the vice principal was a retired stockbroker.
I went to BC High, my friend. I went to BC High.
Yeah.
We're going to do this a lot, Scott. I'm sorry. I can translate afterwards.
Yeah, Scott, you're in trouble. We drove our cars, and we parked them. And sorry. I didn't mean to get off track there, fellas. I went over there, and the vice principal, who was a retired stockbroker, he was doing that as a job because his son had some issues. He was divorced. He was trying to be there for his son. So now, but I remember before I even knew all this, I saw him as a vice principal. Here he is in these nice suits, and I'm saying, geez, this guy's sharp. He's a vice principal at a private high school. Once I learned this, he was a Worcester guy, and he was played 1 year as backup quarterback at the Jets in New York. So when I'm walking down the hall, my friend here, he says, you, dog, my office, and just had a loud voice. And he says, listen, I'm going to teach you. And I said, no, I want to fly under the radar. He said, listen, I was a stockbroker. It's not a geeky job. He said, in fact, for a kid like us to make a good income, we're going to do phenomenal and stuff like that. I did it. You can do it. And I'm not going to lie to you. Money was probably one of my first addictions, or dream addictions, I should say. I didn't have it, but I wanted it. And I'll kind of get into details about that in a second. But where it went was, I was at Arlington Catholic. I looked up to this guy because I wanted to be like him. He had a nice car, nice suits. So I let him show me a few things about stocks. But I tried not to let people know because I didn't want to be a quote-unquote geek. See, I was a chameleon. I was whoever you wanted me to be. I never, ever stood up and wanted to
be. Who do you want me to be? Tell me who you want
me to be. Exactly. And so that's what I did. But behind the scenes, I was interested in stocks. It made me feel good to learn what I was doing and go through there. So I did learn it. I kept it under the radar. And I looked up to this guy. I remember thinking all the girls loved him. All the women mothers thought he was a great-looking guy, great presence. He had a real strong presence. He'd walk in the room, and you just knew who he was before he said a word. You know, and that's – and the reason I'm bringing this up is I always wanted to be this guy, and eventually – I became this guy, and I got all the great qualities of him, but I also, when you try to mimic somebody, you get all the bad as well. So in high school, I remember going through the CAF. Now, my grades were okay. I put some effort in, but I was a terrible student. I had ADHD, everything you could have. At the time, we didn't know it, but I was bipolar. There was a lot going on inside of me. And
There's the anxiety. There's the anxiety you spoke about before, making it
my
seem real.
My anxiety was terrible. So that's just it. My anxiety was horrendous. So I end up walking through the CAF, and this is the best description of how I felt and how insecure I was. As I walked through the CAF at lunch, all I wanted to do was rush to my seats because I was so afraid my fly would be unzipped or I'd spill something. I was afraid people would laugh at me. And I'd get to the seats, and they'd be talking. I'd be like, what are you guys, making fun of me? And they wouldn't even be talking about me. But in my mind, people were making fun of me, criticize. I was so – I can't describe to you, but it was awful. It was so painful that people had such great experiences back then. On the outside, you would have thought I had such a great high school experience. On the inside, I was in a lot of pain. So on the weekends, I would go out and drink. And I would drink, you know, here and there, but not much alcohol. In fact, I'd be the guy who held two drinks and would tell you I'm on number 10. Just wanted your approval, your acceptance. you know.
Oh,
I was a good kid. I didn't break my parents' rules. I had a lot of respect for my mom and dad, and some of it was even tied into fear, okay?
Yeah.
In addition to that, as high school wrapped up and I was going to college, I ended up getting a job. First of all, I was still really insecure, but going into my senior year, I started to work out with weights pretty hard. And I got some muscle on me, and I got some self-confidence in that way. But again, if I met a girl, I would want to make them like my girlfriend overnight because I thought I'm a good look. At that point, I started thinking I'm looking good, I'm getting in shape. But if they got to know me better, they'd see, you know, these teeth have a gap, or they get to know what a goof I am, or how I'm not funny, or how I'm, whatever it was, I felt like if you really knew the real Ryan, you wouldn't like him. Okay, because I wasn't sure. I didn't even like him, you know, and I was in a lot of pain. College came, and my freshman year, I got mostly a scholarship, and here's a touching story. So later on in life, I said to my father, my freshman year, to live there, my parents had paid, there was an X amount of dollar charge. And I didn't know. I thought it was part of my scholarship. I just assumed they got it. I moved home my freshman year. I got mono, and to be honest with you, that was my excuse. I hated living at school. I was too scared. I got rattled by people, loud noise at night. People were out all night drinking. It was a crazy lifestyle, and I just it scared me. So I moved home, and later on I found out that the room and board was not included in my scholarship. My father had sold his trailer that he went camping with in the summer to pay for my first year. Yeah, and my parents
didn't
help me for money. He saved his whole life for this, and this guy goes and sells it for me. You know, I look back, and all I can say to you is I hit the lottery when it came to parents. So my addiction, some people's stories, they grew up in bad parents and this and that. I grew up with, my biggest problem was not enough bedtime stories, you know. So, no, don't get me wrong, my dad wasn't warm and fuzzy, but he loved me, and he did his best. Let's fast forward. So college, I move home. I'm still an insecure guy. I get a job at the gym near my house, and I'm commuting to school. And I see some. Now I didn't want to go to college because I knew I wanted to be a financial advisor, and I knew that I could just get my licenses without going to college and start working and make money. But I got a scholarship to Merrimack, and my father said to me, "Ryan, you're gonna be the only one. You're gonna be the first one of us to go to college.
Yeah,
you're going."
Yeah.
And
that was me
for
a different reason,
school.
But that was me.
Yeah,
I get it.
I got to Bentley and Babson, but I didn't have scholarships yet. My father said, "You're going to college. You're going to Merrimack." And I did what I was told, and I'm glad I did. So I went to Merrimack, and after the freshman year, I had a kid who kind of, I tell people he's my second cousin. We tell people we're cousins. It's more like a friend, but I looked up to him a lot, and I looked up to him because I knew him from one of the gyms. We became friendly. He's a lot older, but always had nice cars, girls all over him, tons of money, was known as a tough guy. So, you know, I wanted to emulate him. That's who I wanted to be like. You know, I didn't want to be a geek, and I didn't want to be scared. I was always afraid of my own shadow. What if I got sick? What if I got that? So I started acting like him, and I said to him, like, what do you do? Got some lifting tips. I got into steroids. I got very, very jacked up. I thought, I'll tell you right now, that's time building my self-esteem. I felt better about myself. Well, okay. He got me a job at a bar called The Rack in Boston. It was you remember the Rack? It was like
The Rack.
The it's spot where the celebrities went. It was Faneuil Hall, where the Hard Rock is now.
I tell you, I used to scoop ice cream in Brigham's in Faneuil Hall, like 1,000 years ago.
Okay, so The Rack was
right there.
It was
got
the it spot, and you know, it was all celebrities. And what I saw there was, you had a lot of people with a lot of money, either athletes or finance guys, and they had fast lives, fast cars, fast this, fast that. So what happened was I kind of got...
I was at the Black Rose, Scott. I got to interrupt one sec. I'm around the corner at the Irish Bar.
Yeah, I know where it is.
Until it got really gentrified, but then I had to go to, like, the Midnight Court or somewhere else because I couldn't afford the door charge. But I know exactly where he's talking about, so I can translate later for you. Go ahead, Ryan.
Okay.
Sorry,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, so I'm working at this nightclub, and it's really, really popular. And so I'm working there as a doorman, and I start really, like, looking at these guys. These people have, like, real money. And, like, and I'm looking up to the guy I look up to. I said, you know, I know what he's doing. I said, can I just start selling some steroids? So I started doing that. And here and there, like, I would do a couple other things for him. Like, you know, when people were betting and stuff, I'd chase down some money. Or, you know, just do legwork.
Yeah.
So sophomore year, it's night. Day after Thanksgiving, and I go home. I'm at the gym, and I get a text message from my parents. Come home now. I call. They go, just get home. I walk in, and my dad's sitting in a chair. He's got tears in his eyes. I said, jeez. Dad, what's up? I go upstairs. My mother was plugging in the Christmas lights, and even now my ears tear up. They pulled out the bed, and there was a bag of money and some steroids and some that, but it was just some stuff that should have been there. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
My father said, you know what? I've never had air conditioning in my car. I've never had a new car. We don't have a lot of the stuff other people have, but I have integrity, and you're ruining people's lives. Get out of my house. And I came back, well, Dad, you know the negotiation. Dad, I'm sorry, it won't happen again. I had this or I had that. He said, Ryan, I don't want to hear it. I said, well, Dad, you can't just make me leave. He said, no, I can't. It's my house. You've got to leave. And take what you can get now and go. So I did. And I've never hated somebody yet respected them so much in my life. So I move out. Right before now, things get worse in college. I'm partying a little more, but it's still not. I was so money-driven. I wanted to build a business that the party was going. I mean, I was into it, but I always kept things in check. You know, here and there, I would dabble and tried a few kinds of drugs like kids do. I think I tried, like, I tried Vicodin once because I had a prescription when I had a mole removed, ironically. And I tried, some other drugs, but just dabble once, literally maybe once or twice. I was afraid of my own shadow with stuff. But at some point, I stopped caring a little more. And I'm about to graduate college, and I know I can't. At this point, I'm living in with a girl in Quincy, and she's paying all my bills, and I'm the opposite of a gold digger, but just, you know, freeloading as a guy. So I said to my father, I went home, and I said, Dad, I'm graduating college tomorrow. I want to move home. And he says, listen, here's some stipulations. Here are the rules. One, you have a 10 p.m. curfew 7 days a week. I don't care how old you are. Two, you give me a bag. Every penny you have in cash, we're going to hold on to. You're done. I said, all right. He said, and three, that BMW you bought, Brandon, bought a new M3. He says, give me the key set. You can drive your mother's Volkswagen with the bungee cord. She had a Volkswagen. The bungee cord held the hood down.
I love your dad all of a sudden.
Oh, such a shitbox. Oh, excuse my language. Such a shitbox. But I did what I had so much respect for my father that I did what he said because I wanted that
good
integrity he had.
Yeah.
And so I did. And I didn't even drink. It took some time off because I was studying for my licenses for work. And I passed all my exams, and things were going good. And my parents told me I bought a two-family about 6 months later. And so by actually probably about 23, right to my 24th birthday, I bought the two-family. So I moved in, and the problem is I moved in with a terrible roommate. And the roommate was me. So I move in, and I'm having anxiety, and I'm a financial advisor at this point. Now, the guy I used to idolize, He was a big scotch drinker, so what I do after work, I'd go out and have a bite to eat and have some scotch. And that's how I dealt with some stress. It was just a few after-work drinks, and I'd close a deal some nights, so I'd stay out a little extra with some guys. But there was no drugs or hardcore stuff. Well, the drinking increased, and it was more and more. And you know, it's like the progression of the disease, as they call it. So next thing I know, but things on the outside, I can't bet. Well, then I end up getting in a fight. Those guys that I idolized once in a while, that we'd be at a nightclub, and they'd say, go hit that guy, start a fight, we're going to clean up. And these guys were serious guys. I mean, these guys, if I said the names, you know right away, they're on the news, they're in newspapers, like, you know, they were that kind of guys. And back then, once I was in the financial world, I didn't want to be like them, but I still, like, admired their courage, their guts, their reputation.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and every time I ever got in a fight, I broke my hip, every time. I mean, I wasn't cut out for fighting. Yeah, I just wasn't meant to fight. I'm not a fighter.
Yeah.
And so the first time, I remember them giving me a script for Percocet. I still remember it was 16 of them. And what I would do is me and my buddy, we'll call him Bob, on weekend nights, we each take one both nights. So we'd take two a weekend each, so that'd be four a weekend. So that script for 16 lasted us the 4 weeks. Never thought of taking one extra or nothing. It was just in moderation, if you can say that. So that happened. I had two scripts. Another time, I'd hurt my hand again. Not for that, but just same thing, same type of surgery. And so same thing. Now, I was like, oh, these aren't bad. And every so often, a friend of mine would have them. So if he had them, I'd say, oh, give me one of those. And I'd say, how often do I take them? Some people drink more. Some people smoke pot. Me, if this perk's around, I'll take a perk. Well, this is where it took a turn. See, drugs and alcohol weren't a problem for me. They were a solution. I felt good-looking, stronger, smarter, better at what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Everything improved. I got bigger homes. I got faster cars. I got faster girls. And that's how my life went. And on the outside, things started looking better and better. And on the inside, I was dying inside. And it got worse. And I got in a lot of pain, and the pain got worse and worse. And at this point, though, nobody's seen it because on the outside, business is getting better. I'm doing all the things that successful person does. You know, the houses, dating. At one point, I got engaged to a girl who I had no business getting engaged to. At another point, I ended up calling that off and just dating some better quality people. But the problem was the better quality people, when they got to see Ryan's behaviors, the truth came out. I mean, it was, you know, it was what it was. I was an addict in early addiction. Even though it was not terrible, it was bad enough that people got fed up with it quick. You know, or I got fed up with them trying to tell me, trying to regulate me. Like, I had one really nice, successful girl. She was from the Midwest, and when she would be here, things would be, you know, kind of out of control on the weekend, but I'd try to moderate it. And then she'd go back to work for the weekend. I'd live a fast life all week. And when she got to the point where she was trying to control it or babysit me a little, I just pushed her away. Things go
Hey, Ryan, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? One of the things I'm curious about during all this is there a conflict? Because I see this a lot, especially in certain, you know, when I work with people in different job types and the expectations and the assumptions, it seems like there's a certain type A personality that's required in the job, that's cherished in the job, almost a motor drive that you have, that then isn't somehow able to be turned off and that feeds these other addictions. I'm just curious, is there something there that I'm hearing? Like, there's part of you that is absolutely fit for this real competitive atmosphere, and then after that particular atmosphere is over, you're still charged and
still
wanting to do... Yeah. Does that make
sense?
Well,
it's geared towards that. Well, absolutely. It's geared towards that. In other words, you look at pro athletes, pro this, pro that. Anybody who's super successful at something, actors. I mean, some actors become the character they're going to be. They act. They turn into that person before they you know, do the shoot. I mean, DiCaprio in that movie they just recently did about the guy years ago, you know, the remnant of maybe. He actually literally slept in an old animal carcass for months before that, trying to become that person.
Yeah.
Well, that's what happened. So I didn't have, and that's how I am in a lot of areas of life. Like right now, I pour a lot of myself into work, pour a lot of myself into the gym, and I'm trying to rededicate myself to put more into my fiance and more into her kids. I'm trying to get more plugged in with her kids. I'm trying to volunteer more. I'm doing a lot more. But, yeah, I don't have an off switch. So if that energy either goes somewhere good or it doesn't.
But you know yourself now. You know you're after. I mean, obviously, you're going
to
say what's happened. Yeah.
And we'll get to that, Ab, because that's a good thing. That's a big thing I touch on. So I was pulling away. I was breaking it off with quality girls. So then I started dating less quality girls or dating multiple people and not being able to stay with one person. Just my life got kind of unmanageable. Let me correct that. My life got very, very unmanageable, okay? And then, so I was having, you know, between drinking frequently and I was just hanging out with a lot of friends, just living a fast life. And ultimately what happened was my esophagus, I had a bunch of bleeding ulcers in my esophagus from pain medication combined with alcohol, combined with God only knows what else I would do when I was out. My esophagus had a hole in it, a few holes in it, and it was called a tear. And the tear was called a Mallory Weiss tear. And what it was is I had such a hole in my esophagus, blood was pouring into my stomach. I would vomit up the blood, and I was losing a lot. So I got rushed to the hospital, and then they said, well, you know, we're going to do this, this, and this, and they have to give me blood transfusions. Well, they did. The blood transfusions weren't filling up my body as quick as I was losing it. So they call on a priest. Now, back then, I had no business with God. I believed in God, but I thought he and I parted ways. We stopped doing business years ago. So I said, get you out of here. Get the, you know, I'm cursing at a priest.
Yeah.
So they sent me out. So then the guy comes in, and I look at the doctor. I said, what's going on? He said, well, we're going to have to do a big surgery. I said, am I going to die? And he says, not on my watch, kid. Now, they read my last rites. I knew I was headed down. There's a good chance I wasn't going to make it out of this. So my mother has a similar sense of humor as me, and that's why I'm going to plug this in here now. But I'm getting wheeled off to the surgery, and my father's crying. My girlfriend at the time's crying. My sister's crying. I look at my mother, and I go, hey, if I die, I'm sorry to leave you with these assholes. And she starts laughing. And that'll play into like where our life is and where my life is today with her.
Yeah.
It's just she's cut from a similar cloth. Oh,
we're real massholes here. That's a real masshole story.
She's a tough
we really
old
are.
Fraud, you know? So that's how it was. So I go in, I had the surgery, I come out, and basically, you know, I'm in rough shape. I come out, they have me in a coma for a little bit. When I get out and they finally get the tube out, I'm talking, and they send a girl in when I'm out of the ICU. Now I'm just in a regular room, and this girl is a nurse, and she says, you know, we had talked to you about your health. And so she's going on about how you can't drink anymore. And I go, what? Are you insane? I go, I can't go the rest of my life without drinking. I'm 27 years old. Are you nuts? She goes, you're going to die if you drink again. I go, yeah, well. So at this point, that'll show you. It's not that I didn't care. I was so sick that drugs and alcohol came before my life. It was what it was.
Right.
They were my life. So I go home, and I'm on a script for tons of pills and all this. I go back about a week later. I had to go back for a follow-up, which was strange. Usually you go back when the staples are coming out. So the guy says, I said to him, hey, what's going on? I said, what are we going to do? He says, well, you know, we had you open. We found some lumps, and those lumps, we took them out, and we did some look at them, and there's some cancerous cells in those. And I'm like, that's not good, you know. And don't get me wrong, when I tell you I had cancerous cells, I did not have full-blown cancer. So there's a misconception.
Yeah.
People start thinking, you know, you can have cancer cells in anything. It doesn't mean you have cancer, you know. So, but they did send me home because they had to do some more surgeries to get the rest of it out of there. It ended up being, you know, strips for OxyContin. And that's where it went. And so it started off a heavy, heavy dose. And before you knew it, I was taking, you know, well over 1,000 milligrams a day.
Wow.
And when this happens to run out, you know, eventually the doctor says, well, Ryan, you don't need it anymore. And I said, well, what am I going to do? He said, well, your options are you stop taking them. You go to a pain clinic and hope they'll keep giving you scripts, you know. But I wasn't in pain anymore, so that wasn't going to last. He said, or, you go on methadone or something, you know, and try to wean off of one. And I'm like, oh, even I knew methadone was a slippery nightmare, you know. So I said, that's a slope that I don't want to get on. I ended up going home, and my answer was this. When the script ran out, I stopped buying them. I bought them on the street. I went through, I won't even say hundreds of thousands, I went through millions of dollars. I mean, between the $800,000 I had, the income I made, which was always, you know, mid six figures, and then everything else, I went through it all. I've got a heavy drug cabinet. I have no money to pay for it. So a certain amount of money, over $800,000 liquid, between five in a 401k and three in a bank. 2 years later, I ended up having zero in the bank, zero in my 401k. I had made $500,000 on average between those 2 years. And I didn't pay my mortgages or my utilities half the time.
Oof.
So I'll tell you, the money was either going to drugs and alcohol, which a lot. I spent about $1,000 a day on drugs. But that's not where all that went, because there's more. Plus, when I earned for income, I was living a fast life. And I was traveling to Miami nonstop. I was traveling to, geez, you name it. I had a girl I was seeing in D.C. I was dating girls all over the place. That girl I was engaged to when I was younger, that I told you I had no business being engaged to, I ended up marrying this girl. So, you know, and you know, I feel terrible that I married someone and put them through that. But flip side is, you know, my issues were very, very, very out in the open. The difference is when we first started seeing each other, my issues were there, but so was my income because I wasn't, you know.
Yeah.
So she was a single mother, and I think it's just, you know, she cared about me. I think she thought I could change and go back to the Ryan I was when I was younger. And I think, you know, the financial part, I mean, I had a good income or so it looked. So I looked appealing in that way, and she looked appealing in the sense that she was a mother, and I needed somebody to mother me and be a babysitter because I was a mess. And two of us got into it. It was not a good situation.
No.
We were married for just about 9 months before we split. It was just a tough, because I was off and on with her for those years, and she had two beautiful kids, and my stepkids, I mean, I still think of them every day. And when I got back on my feet, when I was rebuilding my life, I had a bunch of charges, court cases, legal issues, and they weren't tough guy charges or anything exciting. They were what happens to drug addicts or alcoholics. Over time, you get, you know, DUIs, assault and batteries, or resisting arrest, or just stupid little things. None of it was tough guy stuff at all.
Yeah.
The only tough guy thing I ever did was when I tried to get sober and clean. That was a tough guy thing. Mm. You know, I overcame a lot. But so when I was,
I got a question for you, Ryan, for a quick second, if I could. My addiction is food. As Kevin knows, it's something I work on. I'm a big guy and everything, but I can kind of see it from the outside. Are you able, when you're in an addicted state, and, you know, are you guys able to see this happening to yourself on the outside? Are you living the life that you don't see it?
Are you back then, you mean?
Yeah, back then.
That's an interesting question. Yeah, because I'll tell you this. I remember, it's a really good question because it gives me a flashback. So I'm 29 years old, and I'm walking, or maybe 30, and I'm walking to an ATM machine down the street from my house. And the girl who I ended up marrying, she's at my house with her two kids. And I go to the ATM machine. Now, I don't have a license at this point, but I'm walking to the ATM machine because on the way back, I've got my drug dealer who's going to meet me. Literally, I live like 300, 200 yards from this place. He's going to meet me to drop me the pills while I hit the ATM down there. And I'm pretending to her that I told the kids I'm going to go get them a lollipop or some stupid thing, you know, one excuse after another. So I come, you know, and that's what I do. But I remember hitting the ATM machine, seeing the ATM, because every day, I'd be like, tomorrow I'm going to start over. The ATM slip comes out and there's $70,000 left in the bank. And I'm thinking, holy shnikes, I went, I blew through everything. Everything, and I get 70 grand, and that's not going to last very long at this rate. Might as well go till the wheels come off. And I remember thinking to myself, I did it. Everyone said, now I'm so far down the drain that I'm thinking to myself, I'm never going to come back. I mean, I'm already down, you know, millions of dollars, and I'm about to bottom out. I mean, why even bother? I might as well just ride it out. I'm thinking to myself, I have no shot in hell to rebuild this. I had very few clients. The clients that stuck with me, I wasn't charging anymore. Okay, so I wasn't making anything. And because basically it's hard to go justify charging somebody when you're just a mess. So you just try to service them and keep them happy and do the right thing by them. You know, if nothing else, you salvage your integrity or what's left of it. So we end up going and I'm walking back. So I'm thinking, geez, I'm up a creek. You know, I know this is going bad. I end up in jail. Because of all those charges, like I said, they were terrible charges, one thing after another. So, you know, eventually, if you can't play well in society, they're going to take you out of society. So they put me in jail, and I'm being held. And the first part was like a dangerous thing because it was a fight type thing. And it got better. It got squashed down. And, you know, the people, you know, it basically the court system saw for what it was worth. But I had so many charges for DUIs and what they call suspended time, which means when you get in trouble and they tell you you're supposed to do time, but you're not the type of person we really want to put in jail, so we're going to put you on probation and keep an eye on you, make sure you don't act like a lunatic, and if you don't act like a lunatic, well, then you're not going to have to do your jail time. My issue was that I did act like a lunatic, so...
Yeah, but Ryan, can I ask something, Eric? Because, I mean, my story is very, very different. I'm not going to interrupt you here in this flow, but one thing I'm curious about, with all the DUIs, was there anywhere along the way where there was an intervention somewhere to get you help for addiction, alcoholism?
Just so you know, I only had two DUIs, not only, but, like, it wasn't like there's 15 of them. But,
Right.
The first one was in 2000.
But, no, that treated you like a human as opposed to, like, a criminal. Was there anywhere along in the system, I'm just curious,
Well, that's where I was going to get at the very, very end, I can tie it all together and tell you. So the system, that's just it. They had said to me, Ryan, listen, you know, you get a drug. At first, they were, you know, they're assholes. It's like anything else. But then, when they get to know you and you're on probation, you're not just in that courtroom, right? Then, because at first they see you as a smug guy who's in a suit who broke the law and thinks he's above it. But as they slow down and they get to know me a little and they start saying, all right, I'm showing up week after week. So while I'm on probation, before I even go to jail, I'm showing up week after week and I'm a mess. And my probation officer, they end up not even arrested. Like, they're supposed to put you in jail every time you drink. They gave me a million hall passes because he's like, I knew you were a good guy and you're just struggling and this and that.
Yeah.
But what happened was my PO eventually, well, first of all, before he even got to that point, he's trying to talk about offering you help. He says to me one time, Ryan, you're lying to me. You're doing heroin. And because that's where it gets to me. When I ran out of money, so at one point, I come home from a rehab I went to, and I went down there with an addiction. I always say a high school degree in opiates, like Percocet and Oxycontin. Came back to with a PhD in heroin.
Whew.
The rehab I went to was one of the most expensive in the state, maybe even the country. And what it was a lot of wealthy people. And what I learned was that heroin addicts aren't always homeless guys sleeping on the street.
No,
and,
exactly.
And what I learned real quick was actually, like, a lot of these people down there, they were there and they were heroin addicts. And I'm like, oh. And I kept saying, oh, I would never do that. One guy says, it's the same thing as Percocet. What do you think Oxycontin is made of? Opiates. These are opiates. Yeah. The only difference is that we don't spend nearly as much money as you do to get the high. So when I'm down there and they're teaching these things and these groups and all that, I'm starting to realize, holy shnikes, these guys are really right. Like what I'm doing is the same as doing heroin. So what do you think the next thing I do is? You would think that you'd say, geez, this is the same as doing heroin. I got to stop. My thought was, this is the same as doing heroin. I might as well just do heroin.
Oh my God.
That's where it went. And it took off bad. It took off real, real fast, real hard. So when I came home from that rehab, I said to my fiance at the time, my wife at the time, actually, excuse me. So listen, I'd done everything wrong by her that I could, and she was hoping that would change me down there. And I came back and I said, listen, you got to run for your life. You got two beautiful kids. I've done nothing but cause chaos in your life. And, I owe her a lot of credit. She fought for my life when I wasn't strong enough to do so. About 3-4 years before that, we were just dating, she and I, but we were off and on for, like I said, 10 years. So she got me to go to a 12-step group and the meeting, and I went. And, I met a guy there who rode in on a bicycle. He looked rough around the edges. He looked poor, and he looked tough. And this guy ends up putting up his hand, and he speaks of a God and spirituality and being kind and loving to other men and, like, all this stuff that if you had asked me if I ever – I wouldn't even admit the fact that I thought it was nice to hear, but it was. And so I got his number, and I thought to myself, oh, poor guy. You know, I get back in my car. I have a nice, nice Mercedes, and I'm driving home in my nice suit in my car. And so I go home, and I go, she goes, how's the meeting? Go, oh, yeah, filled with a bunch of losers, you know. Who would have thought? And this guy played a huge role in my life. Turns out back then he was riding a bicycle because he liked to work out, and he was in workout clothes. But he was a Cambridge Health and Alliance here. He was a director in the computer industry side. So he wears a suit and tie every day to work. But here I was judging a book like by its cover, because that's the old Ryan. I used to judge. I just did, even unintentionally you judge, you know. I had met him through a meeting that she sent me to. I sent her to move out because I know things are going downhill. I ended up starting to shoot heroin, and that was the beginning of the end. Over the next X amount of months, I don't remember the exact amount, I shot heroin like anything I had went to it. Everything. I mean, I would sit there in a place that had no lights, no electricity, but I made sure every penny I had. At the very end, I was so desperate, I would let somebody come in, and if there's a TV on my wall, you could take it out of there for a bag of dope. And I was what they call a junkie, you know, when you're just such a junk box, it's beyond words. It got really, really sad, really painful, and really lonely. Right before Thanksgiving one year, my probation officer says, Ryan, I'm not having this. You're going to end up going to jail. I don't want to be in jail. Go get help. I said, all right. So I did. I called to make an appointment to go get help at a cab at Danvers Place. It's a recovery detox. And I was getting a ride there, but I didn't really line it up yet, but I had it all committed to go there, I should say. The ride committed, all that. I got one last paycheck from way before they came in, and me and a friend of mine ran. And we did, by run, I mean we went on a drug run. We didn't leave the house, but we did drug after drug. So we did a lot, and I had about 5,000 left, and I knew I wasn't going to be able to stop this. And I knew even detox wasn't going to help me. So I said to him, here, you can keep this 5,000, but I don't want my parents to find me. I need to shoot up each arm, and I need to put the suicide note in my pocket and throw me in front of this detox. They'll know what to do with the body. I just was done. I had had suicide attempts before, but this was the real deal now. And I get thrown out. You know, good friend throws me out, takes my $5,000, and takes everything that was in my house that was worthwhile. So, because, you know, that's what friends like those do. Turns out that there was an ambulance dropping somebody off there. There's never ambulances going there. There was an ambulance driving somebody there from the hospital who was going to a detox. They saw me. They shoot me with Narcan up the nose like they usually do. It doesn't
bring
me back.
You're an angel.
But they didn't. I was too far gone. They then decided to shoot me right into the chest, and they stick it right into my heart, and they brought me back. And I don't know how. They can't figure it out, but after 2 minutes and 38 seconds of being out, I came back. And, so I wake up in the ICU about a day later, and I said to my father, Dad, I'm never going to do drugs again, never. And he looks at me and goes, Ryan, I don't even want to hear it. I'm here because I had to identify the body. Wow. Now, in the meantime, you mentioned interventions. My ex-wife had tried to get them to do interventions with my therapist at the time, my family. I just wasn't hearing it when I'd go. I wanted no part of stopping. I'm going to tell you the truth. I didn't want to stop. God put the right people in my path that made me stop or helped me to stop. So when I get out of there, I call that detox. I got thrown in front of him, and I said, hey, can I come there as a patient? And for whatever reason, somebody there had a soft spot and said, sure. I went in there, and I went through the detox, and I got out. I went home and checked into the probation, and the guy was fine. And he said, good, just do what you can now. The Woburn Courthouse in Woburn, Mass., they started this thing called the HEAT program, Heroin Education and Addiction Task Force. Mike Higgins and Vince Pirro started it. And so they've been ahead of these opiates since about 2002 or even earlier. So they saw the problem long before anyone else did. So I was lucky. That happened to be my probation officer. It was that courthouse where Vince is the chief. So I had the right people in my path. Now, they didn't like me at the time. They hated me. They wanted to torture me. But they did give me a fighting shot. And they were hard on me. But maybe that's what I needed. So I go, you know, I'm on probation, this and that. I was drinking. They didn't give me a hard time about drinking. Even though it's illegal, they looked at it like, yeah, it's a gray area. I ended up violating probation by getting arrested for another case of getting in a fight. I end up going to be held in jail in Cambridge. I do some time. Then I go up to Billerica. Very, very limited amount of time. So then when I'm in there, somebody says to me, you know, get on your knees and ask God for help. And I'm like, where was God during this? Where was he during this?
Yeah.
And they're like, just try it. And so I did, and then I didn't get anything out of it. And I get a letter in the mail, and it was actually my ex-wife wrote a letter and put money into my canteen. She was the first person I put money in. We hadn't talked in months. You know what I mean? I had broken it off with her. I had another girl living with me while I was partying. Bottom line was, I started praying. Things were getting better in my life, but I just didn't know they were. Because, you know, here you are in jail, held, you're hungry, you're lonely, you're scared, you know, you're tired. And I get out to the edge of the tier I'm on, which is the block, and I look down. And from Cambridge, from my cell, I could see where my office was. When I was younger, I had these two attorneys that were older. And they had an office there, and they would let me work there, and they'd give me clients. And that's how my business got so big. And I'd see my parking spot where my nice car was once parked. And I remember thinking, what happened? My exact thoughts were, how did this happen? And then my next thoughts were, God, you give me one more shot at this, and I won't drop the ball. And since then, I prayed. I would have the whole this vision. I would read positive books. One book that was referred to me was a woman, and it was called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. It was a book geared towards women about walking through your fears and blah. Well, I'm a pretty feminine guy, so my mother sent it to me in jail because that's just how I'm cut. And it actually worked. It spoke to me very well, and I got a lot out of it. And I started applying that stuff. And it was just one thing after another. So I don't know if you need to take a break before you go to the next segment or what's best for you.
Yeah, let's go ahead and take a break. I think that's a
great
topic.
What a story, Ryan.
Point.
That's amazing.
Amazing story, and just can't believe it. And like you said, it's such a peripheral thing, and it happens in incremental stages, and you don't notice it. But now we have the good news coming on the other half where we are today. So let's go to take a break. We're going to play aptly enough from Mildly Medicated, their song Kill Me Inside. Just kind of aptly to what we're talking about here. We're going to come back on the other side. We're speaking to Ryan Skinner about his amazing transformation of his life from, we just heard the downside. Now we're going to hear what he's up to now and what brought him on the other side. So excited to hear this uplifting section now. Just a couple of moments. This is Scott and Kevin on Healing Stigma on Left of Straight Radio.
Yeah.
All right, and we're back. That was Mildly Medicated with Kill Me Inside. Oh, my goodness. If you're listening, hopefully you've been listening to this entire story. We have Ryan Skinner on. Fantastic story we've heard about his road kind of going down the hill there of finding what happens when you get a little bit of alcohol, a little bit of drugs, and it just keeps progressing. When it's just a phenomenal story so far, and we're so excited to have him on. Now we're going to hear how he overcame all this, and I'm so excited to see where he's at now. Let's start, Ryan. Talk a little bit about how did it start coming. Talk about Billy, your sponsor. It sounds like he was a big part of this.
So, yeah, Billy and I came in contact. I told you he was at that the first meeting that my ex, one of the first meetings my ex-wife had made me go to. He was the guy who looked kind of, you know, wasn't real polished up. He was in, you know, like shorts. I used to say they were too short for him. And, but, you know, he was riding a bike, and, you know, he just looked like a guy who just worked out. But at that point in life, I was looking for anything I could find to make me different than you so that you couldn't help me. That was it. I needed to find one reason, if not more, to find out why you couldn't help me, what you didn't have to fit me, or vice versa, and why we couldn't relate. And that was it with me. Like, that was my issue with Billy. It was the fact that he looked like, you know, wasn't in great standing. He didn't look like he had a lot to offer to a business guy. We wouldn't be able to relate. And little did I know how much he really had in common and how much he really could offer, and he ended up offering. But, you know, they always tell you in the program, make sure you try to identify and not compare, because you can compare yourself right out the doors.
Right.
And that was my experience. I did. I compared myself out the doors for many, many years. And that was how it went. So a little more like how I got it or how I identified, which was kind of weird. Like I told you, I'm a pretty feminine guy. So Thanksgiving, that year that I went to that detox, there was a group that came in to speak, and they do what they call commitments. They come in and try to share their experience, their strength, and their hope. Here's this group on Thanksgiving taking time out of their day to come in. And one of the women that spoke in the group, her name was Val, and I can say that she's a good friend of mine today. And Val told a story about a girl who grew up normal parents, normal family, you know, cul-de-sac, you know, family that was married, a German shepherd, you know, pool in the yard. And she became a heroin addict. And I was like, wow, so she came from a normal family too. And she, look at her, and that happened. And she had recovered. And she had a good job. She was married. And she had it pretty dialed in. She lived a healthy life. And I thought, wow, maybe I can get that. And that was where the seed was planted. And I had been to meetings, just so you know, probably about 6 years or more at that point. And never once did I have a sober breath or a clean breath. I either did drugs while I was there in the bathroom or showed up drunk or high. And it's not, and I showed up because I didn't want to be drunk or high anymore. I mean, you know that. Anybody who's a drug addict or an alcoholic, it's not fun anymore. We don't know a way out when we're in it. We just don't. And we don't even believe it's possible. But here was this girl who, from what she said, she lived my life, you know? So I got some hope. So, you know, God works in a funny way. So then I go to the meeting again on a Monday, and it's all those same people that were there, that group, which is now what they call my home group, they were the group that came in. So in the home group, I mean a group you run around with, the people, you tend to click with them, hang with them a little more, you go out and do commitments with them. So, and Billy and Val are both in that home group. So Billy and I would see each other at that meeting because I was friends with the kid who he was sponsoring. And it's kind of funny. We went on a commitment once to that Danvers detox that I was in before. And when we were there on the commitment, I ended up getting thrown out. I got into a fight with one of the kids that was there. So that tells you how healthy I was. Now, I wasn't speaking. I was there just tagging along. But I was drunk, and me and this kid bumped heads. And they said, oh, I'm going to fight, getting thrown out of it. When I'm there to volunteer, it was like, oh.
Wow.
So Billy says to the kid who I was with there, who he was sponsoring, hey, listen, I don't know what your thoughts are, but you got to stay away from that Ryan guy. He's out of control. And sure enough, now Billy's probably one of my best friends and probably like a brother to me now. And he sponsors me, but it's more at the point where it's more of a friendship even. So
that's fantastic,
That was a little bit about that. So here's how it happened. When I go to jail, all those people, I used to fly people to Miami. I used to buy people clothes when we got there, pay for the hotel rooms, the booze, the this, the that. I was, if you were hanging out with me, I was insecure, so you were living on my dime, and I was happy to let you take advantage of me. Okay.
Wow.
When I went to jail, nobody showed up. My ex-wife sent some money in, and that guy Billy shows up. He found out where I was, and he shows up to jail.
Wow.
And then he says to me, you know, do you mind if I call your mother? And I said, well, what do you mind? Do you mind calling a 6-year-old broad who's crying her eyes out? She's never had anyone in jail in her family before, and now you want to hear about it? He said, I'd like to call her and tell her it's going to be okay. So he did. And then he would come see me, and he'd tell me, read these things called the promises. And what the promises basically say, that you will not regret the past. You'll use the past to help others. It'll actually be a source of strength. You won't have financial fears anymore. All these crazy things it would promise you. All these things that you're promising a guy who's in jail, who's a heroin addict, who lost his career, his family, his everything. And you're trying to tell me all these good things are going to happen? Like, thanks a lot, but no thank you, you know? Enough of the BS.
Right.
And every one of those things came true. Every one. And when I tell you every one of them, tenfold. So early recovery, here's how it went. I get through jail. I stop praying. And I didn't know who I was praying to or what I was praying to. But I was told to pray, so I stopped praying. And I asked for help for God that I wasn't even sure I believed in. And I didn't understand it. And I was pretty sure he didn't believe in me or care about me. But I did it. And my life got a little better. And I'm not getting, for some reason, sometimes I'd actually feel a little relief when I prayed. Like some of these things were lifted off my shoulders. Maybe there is something out there. You know, but I wasn't sure, and I didn't have a lot of proof. But I was willing to just guess and roll the dice because I had nothing else going for me. When I was in jail, I would have, you know, Billy would tell me, pray for your probation officer. And I'd be like, oh, screw him, I'm going to kill him. He goes, then pray that if you kill him, his family doesn't miss him. So that's what I would do. And then over time, like, I would start to like the guy. I'd go see him. We'd have to go to court appearances. I'd be brought in from jail. And, you know, we'd just click a little better and say, ah, oh, he's not so bad. And then I pray, God, you know, help me not to kill this guy. Help us to just be polite to each other and passing and just nothing more. And then eventually it was like, God, you know, please help me to get along with him in a positive way, because things were getting better. He was the guy who put me in jail. Was now, for example, I had to go in front of the judge for my last charge. That last case I got arrested for, I hadn't gone in front of the judge yet. They hadn't really finalized it. And I was going to plea out to a felony, but I would have had no jail time because they would have said I served it. I was about to plea out, and he goes to the judge. He goes, excuse me, and he vouches, and he says, this guy was one of the worst cases we've ever had come through here. And he's recovered, and he's doing all the right things. If he gets this felony on his record, he can never do his job again. He's fought so hard to come back. We don't want to stop him now. Let's give him a shot at this. And the truth is, even if you get the felony, in this day and age, everything in life, if you're willing to go forward and be honest about it, everything can be worked out. Everything. So I don't care what's on somebody's record. I tell people, don't tell me what's on your record. Tell me who you are today. Because it will get worked out. So anyways, they ended up giving me probation, more time on probation. I was doing all the right things, so I cruised right through probation. Those guys, you know, Vinny Pierro, Mike Higgins, those guys that were so hard on me that would put me in jail, blah, 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 blah. Today, last year, they had the HEAT conference every year for the program. It's once a year all the judges go, the probation department, all the courts send people there to represent them. Last year, a couple years ago, the mother who started Learn to Cope was the guest speaker. Year before that was Chris Herron, the basketball player. And last year, I was the guest speaker. I was invited to be a speaker. And
wow.
I went in there, and here I am, you know, and I just started off simple with people. I said, listen, I recognize a lot of you people, and some of you probably recognize me. And I might look like a guy you once knew, but that's not who I am. Let me tell you who I am today. And I went about and I told my story, and it went really, really well. And that's how this works. That's how the recovery works. You know, so what I do today, or what I did after that, I pray. When I was in a program after jail, I got sent to this court alternative program, and then I went to a halfway house as a way home. But the court alternative program, I had this lady who was my counselor, and she'd say, do you pray? And I said, well, in jail, I was told to pray and do this and this. But and she's like, well, what do you say to God? I'm like, I don't even know. I just, you know, spit something at him quick. She goes, well, why don't you talk to God like a friend? I said, I can't do that. So she said, why do you stop by writing God a letter? And I go, what? She goes, just write a letter to somebody about what you did that day. And you just put God at the bottom and Ryan at the bottom. God at the top and Ryan at the bottom. So I started. At first it would be, God, I did this, 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 and this about my day. And sincerely, Ryan. Then it was God, blah, 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 about my day. And oh, thank you for this. This went really well. And, oh, and this went well. Thanks for your help there. And, oh, this didn't go so well. I wish you could help me there. And then, thank you, Ryan. Before you knew it, it was like a thank you letter with, you know, I really appreciate all you do for me. I love you. And all this, I found this God that was a warm, loving God that loved unconditionally, that was, that cared. That wasn't, you know, I was raised Irish Catholic. I tell people I'm a recovering Catholic. You know,
that's my line. Scott's heard me say that a number of times.
Well, that's just it. You know, you hear so, it's just, it's so rigid, and you're getting torn apart, and you're always sorry, and I did something wrong, and, you know, I don't want to feel that anymore. I felt that as a kid. I don't want that anymore. This God is, you know, it's you know, still the same individual that was tied into it years ago, but I'm more into spirituality. Like, I talk about when I go to the beach, and I see the ocean, I see the sky, and I see this huge, just this amazing body of water, and birds flying, and they all know what to do, and recently, I was in Bermuda with a guy who sponsors me and the guy who sponsors him. And Billy, me, and Donnie were down in Bermuda at a guy who mentors me. You want a good story? This guy, 2008, we were doing business. I put my business through him. So he was like my upline. So he got overrides and everything I did. 2008, the guy comes to me and says, Ryan, I got to cut you loose. I go, what? Or maybe 2009. What do you mean you cut me loose? I make you a fortune. Ryan, you live like a maniac. I can't be doing business with somebody who lives that way. Now, I wasn't doing anything wrong professionally, but you know, when you're a hardcore drug addict and you're out at strip clubs and living a dirty life and just living the wrong way, you know. So he, anyways, we cut ties. The next year, I have what they call a chargeback. A client changed their mind and didn't want something, so he had to give back. I had to give back my commission, so he gave it back for me, so I could just pay him back because I had gone through him on the money and. Sure enough, I never paid it back because I was off and running doing drugs. Well, years go by, and when I get back out of jail and on my feet, I go through all the stuff I owe, and, you know, and I said, all right, I owe some people some money. I got to get this squared away, so I pay him. And he says, Ryan, I didn't expect to see this. I didn't expect to hear from you. And I knew he had written it off as a loss years earlier, and it had gone to my bankruptcy, and I did bankruptcy, but it wasn't about that. It was about doing the right thing. And he said, why'd you pay us back? And I said, Brian, it wasn't about you, it was about me. And that's really what it came down to. Selfishly, I want to live the wrong way because I like feeling good. I like the way I feel when I do certain things. You know, and that's just it. I'm a feel-good junkie. I used to get it from drugs. Now I get it from helping others and doing kind things. And some people find it corny, but I'll tell you, anybody who knows me knows that I was a guy who was real rough on the edges. And I'm soft these days, and I like that. So
that's cool, man.
You know, I paid him back, and... So Bob Mize, he says, I'm going to start talking to you, following you professionally and blah. So he says, I'm going to start mentoring you again. So he starts coaching me, mentoring me. So about a year ago now, my business was growing. It was doing really well. But, you know, I had a small office and this and that. He helped me grow to be a bigger office and hire some staff. And he helped me grow a really nice business. And in addition to it, it's enjoyable. And it's consistently, you know, busy. So it's not like before my business was ups and downs, and all I do is focus on retirement planning. So he guides me to really find products and tools that nobody else can get. There are only 10 contracts in the country for one of the tools I get to use for seniors. It's an investment that has guarantees on it. And he's got one of them for me. So, I mean, I get such a leg up on the competition. So not only does my business grow, but it grows in a way that, I mean, business will grow either way. But I'm putting clients in, they make much higher returns. Their money's safe. It's an awesome feeling. And that's what I do professionally. So, bottom line is, every day I get out of bed, just to give you an idea of what I do, I roll out of my bed. I hit my knees. I light a candle next to me. And I'm usually dancing because I have to pee, but that's okay. I pray for a few minutes. And I do. I mean, honest to God, after that, I get up. You've never seen somebody get off their knees so fast. I mean, I'll tell you, I'm like lightning. I run to the bathroom, use my bathroom, I get downstairs, and I light another candle. I do some other prayers, and I do some positive readings, and just some stuff to get my head right. And, you know, I asked him, I said, you know, allow me to be a service to clients and people using my talents. So for my clients, help me use my ability to do unique retirement plans and protect their assets to make sure they don't lose money. Help me to use those talents to be a service to them while growing our business. You know, I bring God in as my business partner. So if I do the legwork and I do what it takes to get clients well off, he takes care of me. Business just pours in, you know. There's no other way to put it. But if I look out for Ryan, well, then I'm on my own. So as a result, I do that. I ask him to help me be a service to other alcoholics and addicts. and people stop praying. And then I say, all right, let me go one step further and help people who I have no tie to. See, Alcoholics and Addicts, I have a vested interest because I am one. So I want to see those people get relief because it makes me sad. So it's kind of selfish. It's like taking care of my own. You know, when it comes to business, you know, I want to take care of my clients because I want to see my clients happy. I want to take on people and make a difference in their life because I feel good, because I get to see them on reviews and see how happy they are. So it's a positive for Ryan again. But I also ask him to help me be a service to people I don't know. I'm involved with the Woburn Council and Concern where I donate money. I don't get involved. I don't take the rush out of seeing the people. I literally donate the money. The lady laughs. I donate the money and I head out the door. And that's it. I don't want any of the credit for it. I get enough credit in life these days. You know, I don't want blame when things go wrong places. And I really try, you know, I love the Gandhi quote when he says, the best way to find yourself is lose yourself in the service of others. If you think about that, when you're doing for other people, think how good you feel. I mean, you guys are into helping others. How good do you feel when you help somebody?
Well, especially, Ryan, after what you had been through, which was the most selfish, self-serving thing, even when you're caught up in it and hate it, it's still ultimately serving something inside yourself that, as you said, it's almost like another form of cancer in a way, the addiction. And if you don't mind me, you know, it's another form of
being an addict.
Yeah, and so you're doing something that's so, and now to help others that has that positive return, but is a win-win situation. It's it's a good high. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
It sounds like a good
high.
Yeah.
Absolutely, and it's right now I ended up starting at Bill Ricker House Correction. You know where Bill Ricker is, obviously.
Yep.
Bill Ricker House Correction. I was in there, and I my criticism was with the jail system is this. You take people out of a system that's terribly flawed. You give them a record where they're not very employable after. And then you expect them to go provide for themselves. And, you know, and you don't give them any of the talents to go do things. Like, there's a million jobs you can do if you have a negative, you know, career criminal record. But most, you know, you got to teach these people, hey, you can do this, this, and this. So I ended up going, and there's a guy named Ed Blue who runs this thing called Recover Reality. And he has a website, recoverreality.com. And he's a guy, if you ever want to get in touch with somebody interesting to have on. So, Ed, he's the head of the APOD up there, and he's the head of the ARC program, which is recovery program. And, you know, he's been saying for years, it's light years behind. I mean, it's just the old recovery stuff. You send somebody in to tell war stories. They talk about how tough they were, how bad they were, how this and this. Then they tell you to go sit in church basement 7 days a week, and you're going to get better. And it doesn't work that way. So he was open-minded enough to give me a shot at bringing a program I wanted to bring in based on the book called The Obstacles the Way by Ryan Holiday. Mm-hmm. And I brought that in. The kid I sponsor and myself, we go in and we basically teach us. We give it. It's a 10-week program. We have these guys do the reading, the inmates. Each week we give them homework to read, and we give them journaling to do. And every week that's how it goes. Mm-hmm. And it's been – the first round went so well that – the second round was starting this Friday. It's another 10-week segment. And we have guys that we're going to be able to parole that are staying. One guy's staying an extra 2 weeks because you have to commit to the whole program rather than parole to the street the way he is because he thinks he can get something out of it.
That's amazing.
Wow.
And here I am,
that's
a useless
amazing.
Junkie like me, a guy who was a bottom of the barrel, a drug addict, you know useless person, you know, making some small difference in somebody's. And that's just God working through us because, you know, up to myself, I'm not that selfless. But when God takes control, we let that energy, you know, and that's what I believe God is. It's one energy that we're all tied to. You know, each of us needs all of us. We're all one. You know what I mean? There's really no you and me. It's all we. If you look at the universe, I mean, there's a complete balance of, like, the air and the water and all. We get so wrapped up in our egos or identities, it's just insane.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that. I'm going to pause into a little bit of the layman's terms here because for me, and it comes from a different side, Ryan. And well, you know, Ryan, trust me, this won't be the last time you're on the show. When you have something that you want to talk about, you're always invited on Healing Stigma because that's what you're doing. You're helping people heal their stigma and move on with the other things they need. But the one thing you're saying in this is so true, I think, from one of the things that I see that happens with stigma is you get broken off from your community. Now, this is an interesting story you just told. Someone is choosing to stay, you know, another 2 weeks because this is giving them something. And that's also something you're creating, which is community. You're listening and teaching, but listening to people with a full, respect for who they are. And when we stigmatize people, be it a junkie, be it for poverty, be it for, you know, in my situation that I had done porn, yeah. And oh my God, this guy, here's a guy. I mean, my situation was this: even though I'm from the exact same side of town, Ryan, as you, I had a father who hated, couldn't stand what was going on in Southie, and scared the crap out of me. So I had my education, but it's also the part that I had poverty at a time when I did what I did for legal work to keep my family off the street, and yet it still cost me, you know, 1.5 million people see you as the porn star teacher on the evening news. Well, guess what? It doesn't matter whether you're behind bars.
Can I say one thing about that?
Yeah.
You did a legal job, and it's nobody's goddamn business. That's all I'm going to say. If you're not doing something...
Yeah, but hang on. Hey, I'll say this. You're right. Ryan, you're absolutely right, except for here's let's come out the other side, because I won't go on about my story right now. Our listeners know that.
No,
but here's the crazy thing is, for me, it was also the lemonade that came out. I now have a book of poetry that I never would have written, probably, if I was just teaching English to high schoolers. When they locked me out of that, I had to do what I had to do. And that was, for me, a creative side that still helps people. So the funny thing is, when these things happen, when you lose your community and you're stigmatized, if you can find the right – your community you found after being incarcerated is a community that gives back as much as you give to it. You had a community before when you were an addict, and as addicts will do, as you said, unfortunately, even a good friend would wind up taking money and everything you had to leave you with a suicide note.
Imagine, yeah.
You know, so community is something we forge, and when we do that by healing stigma, and Ryan, you're a hero for doing it for people that don't have it yet.
I don't know about that.
No, it's true. It's true. When you take what you have, your story, and you express it, I happen to be somebody who had it with the teaching. It was just taken away in a sense that I knew I wanted to keep writing, and that's why I do it. But in telling your story, you said it, you're giving people journals. This is all expression, but that expression has to be told to someone, and you have to have it in your head that someone kind of cares, and that's where community comes from, and you learn your whole identity, not by being a label or a stigma. So I don't mean to teach here, but that's what, Ryan, that's what you're doing, and for our listeners, it's one of the things. If you feel you're being stigmatized, find the right community. And if you don't know, reach out to us here at Healing Stigma Radio. We'll do everything we can to help you find the right community that's positive and gives you positive feedback.
And that's one more thing. Just so you know, anybody listening who has questions or concerns, and there's anything, you know, if I can be a service to anyone, reach out to these gentlemen. Guys, you're welcome to, as long, you know, touch base with me and feel free to pass, you know, pass the info along. Maybe I can be a service somehow.
We're going over, I'm reading your website, and I encourage all of our listeners, RyanTakingStock.com, fantastic website, tells all about this incredible story and all about the testimonials are fantastic. But you have this Ryan Fund that you're looking to create. Tell everyone about that. I think that's the most amazing thing.
We have created. That's, a lot of people say it to me. They say, are you looking to create this? I said, no, we have.
Good.
We have the Ryan Fund. What we're looking to do is raise money, and here's how it got started. Here's what the driving force is. When I get lazy and I don't want to go speak in certain things or selfish, here's what happens. May 1st last year, I looked at the cover of the Herald, and I'm literally in my room right now looking at this because I saved it. There's a girl named Jocelyn Prey, okay? Jocelyn's parents overdosed within 2 weeks of one another, and they were both dead. Okay,
yeah.
Jocelyn's family, you know, she's a 10-year-old girl, and as often happens in the household of heroin, I'm sure the mother probably, you know, I don't want to bam up, probably did some interesting stuff for money, and there's probably some stuff going on. And so this girl saw a lot or was involved in a lot. Needless to say, nobody from either side of the family wants her. So she goes into, she becomes an orphan. So I reach out because it was tied into this church in Southie where there's a certain church that buries a lot of the addicts that don't have money and stuff and whatnot. So I reach out and say, hey, listen, you know, I tell my story quickly to the person on the other end of the line. I said, I'd be interested in either playing a role in this girl's life. I said, or I could even adopt this girl. I said, my fiance has 3 kids. She's in recovery. I had a heroin addiction. I'm in recovery. God's blessed me. I'm building a big house. At that time, I was building my house. I said, I have a beautiful business. And I said, I'd love to give back. And I said, this could give me a shot you know, for years I didn't have a child because I held off because of my issues. I wanted to make sure I was stabilized. I'm stabilized, and here's a shot to help this girl. You know, can I have it? And they came back and said, you know, well, due to your, you know, your past, we, you know, that wouldn't be appropriate. And I said, wow, no, I have nothing bad on my record, you know, in terms of, like, children and stuff like that, or sexual stuff, right? And, I, you know, of course, I got a little sour because here's a priest from South Boston, a Catholic priest, of all places and of all communities, tell me about inappropriate, who belongs with kids and who belongs, you know what I mean? So I didn't handle as well as I should have, but, you know, I was upset and I was hurt, and I was more hurt because I said to him, listen, two of my best friends were raised in foster care. They're actually foster brothers. And their father, they were fortunate enough to be placed in a home where the father was an award-winning foster father. In fact, he won a bunch of awards from Dukakis, a bunch. And I said, you know, I said, what's interesting is throughout all those years, they were raped and physically abused. I said, so you're going to tell me because I happen to get drunk and get in a few fights and a DUI or two, that I'm less suited to, you know, I said, don't, you know, I think you're judging people. And, you know, it's funny for a religion that tells you to be kind and loving. It's not a, but that's neither here nor there. So anyways, I was hurt by it. I was devastated. Frankly, I was thought to myself, you know, here's what
you were stigmatized. You were stigmatized for something that you weren't.
You know,
you were given a label and judged and prejudged for something that you weren't. Yeah.
Absolutely. And you could, you're absolutely. And sometimes I didn't know at the time how to label my pain, but I was just hurt. So I get choked up just talking about it. So here it is. This is how the situation goes. And it says, okay, how do I help this young lady? What can I do to help? I mean, really. So I prayed on it because my thought was, here's this girl. Nobody's going to take her as a foster child because she's got so many issues. And anybody who's not a heroin addict or an alcoholic who does take her, chances are they're going to be the ones abusing her. You know what I mean? So any normal person, normal people don't bring this into their house. If they do, there's usually something screwed up, you know? So, and I hope I'm wrong. So my thought was, geez, you know, God, the one thing I'm good at is I'm good at managing money for clients, and I'm good at raising money. Like, I have it to a point where I could go to my clients and say, listen, you know, I have clients that have offered to let me inherit millions of dollars, literally. And I said, nah, that's not appropriate. And I didn't know where to guide them to with it. Well, now I have a lot of clients that they're trusted. You know, they're going, it's going to the Ryan Fund. And that's pretty amazing. And so, if anyone out there wants to help, just to let people know, the Ryan Fund, there is no profit whatsoever going to Ryan at all. In fact, if places want to hire, what I do is I go speak at high schools, colleges, things like that. And we don't set a flat rate like some of the other speakers do because I don't believe in that. Because some schools can't afford what others. But what I say is reach out to us and we'll find a fee that makes some sense. And rather than the fee going to me as a speaker fee, we put it as a donation to the Ryan Fund.
That's fine.
So I do it without taking a penny for it. And our job is there to raise money for these kids. I don't need to. God's been good to me. I make a good living every day. But I want to make sure that somehow we can make – there's a lot of kids living – I mean, you look at those commercials. There's kids living in, you know, station wagons with their parents, for crying out loud. We're in the richest – I mean, we're in one of the richest states on earth. And so it's just – I don't mean to get amped up, but it really, really upsets me. I go to, like, conferences with people in my industry, and we'll be in, like, the top 20 producer lunch that this guy hosts for the top 20 guys. So all of us are making huge money. Between 20 of us, you got to figure we're making, you know, at least 30, 40 million a year. So I said to these guys, if we all each donated just, you know, 10% of what we made to help people, there wouldn't be so, I mean, think of the difference we'd have in our state. So anyways, if somebody wants to help out, and it's not just exclusively towards kids that lost their parents to addiction, which is a big part of it. It's to people that are impacted by addiction. So there may be people who are just the husband and wife are homeless, you know, and they're not. So we don't just hand addicts money, but we try to make sure they have a roof over their head. We provide food. But the first and foremost, my goal, number one, at least for the time being until we get to a level where we have enough money to do otherwise, my priorities are kids that are impacted by poverty, especially due to drugs. Kids, it's just for me, kids. I see, when I see animals and kids, I see God. You know, so, that's it. My website is RyanTakingStock.com. Talks about who I am, who I was, and the man what I did to become the man I am today, and what I do to keep growing as a person. Because I think, you know, there's no beginning or end. It's all about the journey. And the best part of all is that I used to think that it was a destination, some kind of something I was trying to achieve. And what I realized is, I just want to live today. Like, right now I'm present. I'm on the phone with you.
Yeah.
I do not have my cell phone in my hand texting. I am not, you know, watching TV quietly. I'm not reading. Like, I'm present because this is, and I'm enjoying it. I'm getting a lot out of talking to you. I'm learning from you folks. I don't know a lot about your radio station yet, but I'm interested to learn more.
You will.
Even the conversation, even me talking to you guys, I'm getting something because I'm saying, geez, you know, I never thought of that.
Yeah.
Or, so it's a
Have
lot
you lost
Ryan,
the anxiety, Ryan? Have you lost the anxiety, or do you find that you cope with the anxiety?
You know, being recovery is not a silver bullet, but my bipolar is far more manageable. I am on far less medication. I am
That's not brilliant.
On any ADHD medicine, although it's arguable that I might need some. But I came off my ADHD medicine because it was a stimulant. I don't believe in that. Because my recovery, this isn't for everybody. Because I'm not trying to tell people. But for me, there was a other way to do it. I'm into meditation. I do a lot of meditating. You know, I do a lot of I keep my life very chaos free too. You know, I mean, I date a girl who, I mean, my fiance's amazing. You know, she's just amazing.
You.
Yeah, she's my rock. She's my soulmate. You know, my mother and father that I broke. My mother works for me. I tell people my mom, it's like an episode of Everyone Loves Raymond. She's like Marie. She is. She always. Gets
all right,
here
I gotta meet
this,
you, man. I gotta meet you. I'll report back,
to.
Scott. I'll let you know. I gotta meet this guy. I gotta see this guy in action.
I would love to. I think it'd be awesome to meet connect. And maybe you guys will know somebody where, you know, if you ever need me to go speak, you have somewhere I could
speak.
We'll
have a coffee, man.
I would love it. I would love
Trust me. We're going to have a coffee. You can still have the stimulant of caffeine, right? Or do I need to get you decaf?
I drink plenty of caffeine. You kidding me?
Good.
Listen, So the RyanTakingStock.com is the site people can check out. It also
it's
has
brilliant.
Testimonials and letters by everybody under the sun, especially people from the state that were on the opposite side, or even the captain of the police force that was the head of the narcotics division. I did so many drugs, they thought I was buying them to sell them. I bought so many. And
this
guys,
is, remember, this is on a serious side. This is a state that we're losing 3 people a day right now on average. And I'm down, and I'm south of Boston, so you know, down on the South Shore, it's
guys. You know, I appreciate
good
the
people here.
On here. I am.
We just want to thank you so much for telling your story, Ryan. I mean, it's a story that needs to be told. I mean, it's tough to hear, but the upside is look where you're at now. I just want to thank you for all you're doing. I mean, just for our listeners, you're sponsoring Recovering Addicts. You're doing these speeches to high schools and colleges, working with the Middlesex House of Corrections. The Ryan Fund is just an amazing deal. Hope everyone, again, goes to the web. That's www.ryantakingstock.com. Listen to the story, and I hope that everyone will check. I mean, let's keep your business, too. We got to plug that business here. Working at Summit Financial Partners in Woburn, Mass.,
we have one of the most unique, and I'm not just saying this because it's us, because when somebody's in their 20s or 30s or even 40s, we're not a good fit for them. So I don't BS and say, hey, we're everything to everyone. But for somebody who's within 5 years of retirement or retired, we have an ability to use investments to guarantee that their money is insured and guarantee that it can go up. And when it goes up, they keep all that money. It's safe. And it's fully insured also. So we're retirement specialists. And I will tell you, we do it. That area, we do better than anyone. So, if anyone's a retired, even within 55 or older, go on Summit Financial Partners. That's SUMMIT, financialpartnersplural.org. And, you can just register for one of our workshops or shoot an email up to me. And just one other thing before I go, you see all of these. I mean, I see people doing a GoFundMe Facebook for, like, they want to travel to Florida. They're not hard up for, they might be college kids and they're bums, but they're not terminally ill. It's not like Make-A-Wish or whatever. And people fund them. I'll tell you, if you go on our site and, you have a couple of bucks, please feel free to donate to that charity. It's not a single dime goes to us. Nobody gets paid to manage it. There's not a single, usually with those things, even if the person like myself isn't getting paid, they have to pay for administrators, this and that. Everybody who's involved with that site, when it comes to the raising the funds, is completely either paid out of my pocket or they're volunteers. So if you got a couple of bucks, go on there and say, hey, listen, I'm going to throw a couple of bucks towards this little girl. 20 bucks here, 30, that's how it adds up. So, you know, I'm not asking for him, but I'm asking if you're one of those people who likes to donate, loves the idea of making a difference, but says, hey, I really can't afford to. It's not about some big, grandiose thing. It's little thoughtful moves, singles and doubles.
That's great, man.
Awesome.
That is
hey,
great.
God bless. Keep doing the work you're doing, you know. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for being a guest, Ryan. We're definitely going to have you on again, and we really appreciate you sharing your story with us. You have a great evening, my friend.
Bye now.
All right, my friend. Thanks, Ryan. That was amazing. I tell
amazing
you, man.
Amazing story.
That really, and you found, I just want to let our listeners know this. You found Ryan.
Yeah, I did. I'm working with this great, I try to work with a couple different publicists for the entertainment show.
Yeah.
And asked them to give me some clients. Like I said, this guy has a lot of different diverse clients. And he just throws me people every once in a while, send me an email and say, hey, what do you think about this person?
Yeah.
And he sent me Ryan's resume, and it's like, how could he not be on this show? I mean, he's just the epitome of what we're talking about on dealing with your problems, having problems, facing the stigma of it through his family, through his friends, and then recovering and coming out the other side. It's what we're all about.
Well, that's just the thing, you know. Ryan is someone who's come from, the same area that I come from, but our story is vastly different in some ways. And yet, when you go through a stigmatizing process like that, and you see survivors from so many, you know, notice what he said. The one thing I want our listeners to think about is this: and that great, great story. There's so many different parts I'll probably pluck out later in my mind. But he said, suddenly I saw someone who was like me and had recovered. You know, he actually saw someone, he heard a story, and he heard that, and he was able to, you know, people get through stigma in so many different ways, you know, and once you get through it and you find that community and you find out more of who you are, I mean, wow, that guy sounded so positive on the second half of that call compared to what he had to go through and telling us the first half of his story that, you know, I was just absolutely kind of doing the fist pumps in the air with him on that second part when finally someone said, look, it's okay. You can be an addict or a junkie or whatever you're calling it from every walk of life, but you can also recover. On the news sometimes all we hear about is statistics and who we're losing. If you don't feel that anyone's going to make it, then, yeah, you're going to bottom out as well.
Exactly. Oh, man, it's just another great show. We're already halfway through May. I can't believe it. Next week, we're going to have the Ladies of Same-Sex Dialogue on the show.
Yay!
That's going to be a fun show. Fun show.
Oh, they are amazing. They're just wonderful. Well, I can't wait for them to be on.
Thank you so much for staying in. We know this is a long show, everyone, but we really thought that it was something that you guys needed to hear. And I think hope you guys got out of it as much as Kevin and I did. But we appreciate you listening every week for us. Again, check out the website, www.healingstigmaradio.com. Follow us on Twitter, @HealStigmaRadio. And
get us over 1,000. Get us over 1,000. I want over 1,000. Keep following.
There you go. Be part of the conversation. If you have any questions or anything, we're going to be doing, I think next week we might be having, at the end of the show, maybe even Tiggy will be making a surprise return.
Wow.
And we maybe get some questions. We'll be shouting, check the Twitter feed, and we'll be asking for some questions. So
that's great.
Yeah, we got
and I've also got some great new musical. We're running out of time, so we'll talk about it next week. We've got some, I want to thank all the musicians and the great new news that we've had from people who are sending us stuff. We're going to have some great music coming up on the show as well that all tells a story and is all forms of expression that, you know, challenge stigma and show us identities as such wonderful, wonderful folks. I love all the guests we've had and all those that are coming up. Thank you.
No problem. Kevin, it's always my pleasure hosting with you. It's another great week. Again, next Thursday, join us right here on Healing Stigma on Left of Straight Radio at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern Time. We will have the fantastic Same-Sex Dialogue ladies on. We're going to leave you tonight with a final song from Mildly Medicated, Brightly Into the Sun is the name, as we go through the positive ending of Ryan's story there, and we will look forward to seeing you next week. Thanks again, and here we go. Into the Sun by Mildly Medicated.